Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. Established as Schroders Ventures 35 years ago, when the industry was nascent, the firm evolved into Permira in 1997, and today has 60 billion euros under management, employs over 450 people, and operates in 16 offices worldwide. Permira has backed over 300 businesses, many of them like Hugo Boss, Doc Martens, McAfee Software, household names. So to discuss, explore, unpick, and assess Permira's proposition and approach, I'm delighted to welcome Tara Alhadef, partner with responsibility for their brand investment strategy within the global consumer team. So Tara, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon.
Well, when I was reading your background and saw you studied, I knew you shared the same credentials as one of our guests last year, so I had to go and look it up. And in fact, it was Tilly Franklin, who is CIO at Cambridge University and another PE professional. So let's start with your education. You studied economics at Cambridge and you also have an MBA from Harvard. What did each of those give you?
First of all, I've been fortunate to have benefited from an amazing education from a very young age. And I've often thought about how much I've benefited from the quality of the education I've had from probably secondary school onwards. I think Cambridge and Harvard gave me two very different things, I would say. Cambridge gave me probably independence of thought. So as you'll know, the British higher education system is not quite as structured and regimented as some other countries are, and is very open, free-flowing, very much what the student makes of it themselves. I had gone to a very structured secondary school. So Cambridge, I think, forced me or encouraged me to learn how to think a bit more for myself about how I wanted to spend my time and develop a bit more independence of thought, I would say. I went to Harvard for my MBA a bit later in my mid-20s when I'd been working for a few years before. So I think Harvard was clearly much more about business and like-minded business people. And it gave me the opportunity to pause career-wise and lift my head above the parapet a bit. I'd been in an investment bank before that. So that was more about pausing career, lift your head above the parapet, look around, look at what business can mean to different people and what different types of business or finance career paths were. And just 2 years, really, of exploring that socially or in a classroom. or through internships and so on. So that was a bit more about career refinement. And I must mention, I met my husband.
Well, what can I say? That's terrific. But you were at Morgan Stanley. I know you were an M&A. So how does Morgan Stanley fit into the pre and post Harvard and Wyndham Pimira come along?
Morgan Stanley was my 3 years after Cambridge, before Harvard. I joined there. As you say, I did M&A. Actually, I did 1 year in what was called the convertible bonds team in capital markets, which was interesting because I had no idea what a convertible bond was. So I did 1 year there, and then I did 1 year in M&A in London, and then I did 1 year in New York. So I jumped around quite a bit in my 3 years there. And that was me finding my feet, understanding what a bank was, what finance was, what flavor of this most appealed to me. And that was when I said, I think I know what I want to do, which I thought was private equity, but I'm not entirely sure. So an MBA seems like a really good way of getting the lay of the land and looking around and comparing some other options. And then I went to do the MBA and did an internship at Permira while I was doing that, and then came to Permira straight after that, which was now 14 years ago.
Wow, the power of the internship. So let's jump to Permira. I mean, my understanding looking at your documents is that when we think about your investment approach, it's been quite specifically sector-focused, tech, healthcare, and consumers. So maybe just tell me a little bit about how you're organized.
So you mentioned three of our four sector teams there. We've got tech, healthcare, consumer, and services as the fourth. Today, I would say most private equity firms of our scale are sector organized, but I believe we were one of the first to think that we should be sector organized, probably going back, 15 or more years now is when we became sector organized. And that was really about realizing that to be differentiated investors, you need to be better at assessing risk than somebody else. How are you going to be better at assessing risk? You need to really know an industry inside out as a specialist, as a bit of an insider. So it's 15 plus, maybe even going to 20 years that we've been sector organized. And those four sectors that we have today have been core to what we do for most of that time. So yes, we are very much sector organized. But the other thing we're very proud of and is very important to us at Permira is the number of offices we have globally and the local feel that we've kept, not just feel, the local reality that we've kept with teams on the ground across Asia, the United States, and most of the European capitals as well. So we're sector organized predominantly, but we also have very strong geographic networks and expertise and people on the ground as well.
So 60 billion euros, seven or eight funds, great track record. How would you, in a sentence, explain Permira's continued success?
In one sentence, I would talk about our ability to adapt and evolve. So Permira is one of the private equity firms that had, for example, an internal leadership succession very early on. And we've now gone through multiple leadership successions within the firm's history, which is quite unusual. If you look at the big, big private equity firms, a lot of them are still led by the original founders. So the ability to evolve, adapt, bring in fresh thinking, bring in fresh blood, have a dynamic partnership at the top. So the leadership of the firm has evolved and changed. I think that is quite crucial to our success. And it's meant that we've evolved our investment strategy as circumstances changed as well. So you may or may not know, the firm went through a very difficult patch around and after the global financial crisis. It was not a given that the firm would emerge, let alone thrive from the global financial crisis. We had a few very challenging years. And I think the fact that we not only emerged, but really thrived is down to the fact that we evolved our investment strategy, had a lot of leadership strengthening and changing, and this theme of evolution, adapting, I would say agility.
And we had an interview just last week with Petershill, who of course are one of your strategic investors, which sort of, you know, dovetails nicely. Let's talk about the consumer. It's your speciality. I think that I'm right in saying approximately that when you measure consumption as a percentage of GDP, it's somewhere just over 60% in the UK and approaching 70% in the US. You're in charge of brand investing. I think it was Jeff Bezos. He said a brand for a company is like a reputation for a person. You earn reputation by trying to do hard things well. So what are the key considerations you as a team look at when thinking about committing capital to brands?
You're right about your statistics of consumer spending, and that's what I love. Who isn't a consumer? I'm so lucky to spend my time being able to talk about brands and what people like to consume and what makes a good one or not, rather than much more complicated and technical things. On the one hand, brands seem so fluffy, so qualitative, so hard to pin down, and certainly so unfinancial. On the other hand, there is a lot more science and analysis around what makes a good brand or how to make a brand better or analyzing a brand than people think. So we in our brand investing team live in that space of trying to respect what's qualitative and nebulous about brands whilst trying to give scientific answers to what makes a brand good or bad. So to answer your question, we look at how emotionally connected are consumers to that brand. That can start with just awareness. How high is the awareness of a brand? That's at the most vanilla end of a brand. So everybody knows in the UK, Tesco or Barclays, huge brands. But how emotionally connected are they? So do they say that I love this brand? Do they say that I want people to associate this brand with me? Do they say I'd be open to having different experiences with their brand? So we have designed a set of questions that we ask thousands of consumers about brands, and we can score how well brands do on love, for example. How loved is a brand? So that's one bucket of emotional connectivity. Brands are emotions at the end of the day. Brands are not science. They really are emotions. So the deeper your emotional connection, firstly, the more pricing power you have, the more stickiness and loyalty you have, and so on. So that's why we really, really focus on emotions. Then we focus on how do people behave about this brand? How often are they interacting with it? Are they following it on social media? Do they comment about it? Do they share thoughts about the brand with their friends? So that's consumers' behavior. The first one was psychology in their head, what they don't know they're doing, but what they think. The second one is their behavior. What are they actually doing about this brand? And then the third one is how distinctive is what this brand is doing? So do you have a management team that are really out to do something different that no one else is doing? Because the world of brands is very crowded and there's all sorts of people trying to set up their new brands all the time. So truly how distinctive is either the product, that could be something technical in the product that you've designed, or it could be that your business model is distinctive. It could be that you've created a subscription model or something omni-channel that's unique. Is your product distinctive and or is your business model distinctive? And then finally, the fourth bucket is just what does your P&L look like and what does that tell us about your brand? Because usually if you've got a fabulous brand, it's showing up in your P&L. You're not pricing as a multiple of your costs of producing the good or the product. You're pricing a little bit the emotion. So it'll show up in your P&L and your profit margins, the quality of your brand. So of course, we spend a lot of time on the financials as well. But those first three buckets are where we try to put more structure and science behind figuring out what a really good brand is from an investor's point of view.
That's very helpful. So I'd like to dive into a couple of live examples, Doc Martens and Golden Goose. When reading about Permira's approach to rejuvenating and enhancing brands, you said, and I'll quote you, heritage brands need a different lens and heritage brands are where magic can happen. Tell me about the Doc Martens story.
Well, you're not really expecting to talk about magic when you work in private equity, are you? But I'm glad you've asked about that. It really is a near perfect example of what an interesting brand investment for us is. First of all, the brand had been around for 60 years. It's globally known. So almost anyone in almost any country, you can ask and they know something about what it is. They'll say, yes, that boot, it's black, it's got a thick sole, it's got a yellow stitch. You can go to Chile, you can go to Vietnam, and I promise you people know what Dr. Martens is. So 60 years of heritage, global awareness, and then this rich, rich heritage and history. So it was adopted by punks, goths, rock bands. Pete Townsend went to bed famously every night with his Doc Martens and a bottle of whiskey or something. So it's deeply steeped in culture and subculture. So it had this huge awareness, now emotions. So the subculture steeped in history, particularly British and particularly music history, is where the emotion bit of what I was talking about before came in. So people said, I love my Doc Martens, when you interviewed them today or when we did the deal 8 years ago. So it had this love and emotional connection with people that was truly unique. All of that was true, but the business had never done any advertising, any conventional marketing, and on a global scale was quite small. So it had £200 million of revenue, which isn't tiny, but given the awareness and the emotional connection of the brand, we felt that £200 million of revenue for a business that sells to men and women in every country in the world. It sells to 15-year-olds and it sells to 50-year-olds. It's not a lot of revenue for that size of a brand. So the basic aha moment we had with that one was, and at this point I'm using my hands, people who are listening can't see, but the brand was sort of this big. So I've got my hands spread massively wide open and the business was this big, which is small. The brand was bigger than the business. So the thought was, well, how can we unlock what's magical and special about this brand and turn it into a bigger, healthier business without spoiling the magic and the emotion of the brand? So that was 8 years ago that we embarked on that journey. And it's been an incredibly powerful, rich journey that's ultimately been a huge success, but not always gone in a straight line. But it's just a fantastic example of what we think brand investing can mean.
So just staying with it, and specifically, when private equity gets involved with business, there can be lots of different outcomes and there can be quite significant pressure for the PE investors to see the results. Tell me a little bit about how you work with management. And I think that, again, I'm going to quote you, but I think you said to the CEO, run this business as if you're going to pass it on to your kids. Tell me a little bit about how those, what can be tensions, work.
The reason I said it is that I think it captures the tensions really well. So if you're going to pass a business on to your kids, you want it to be healthy, you want it to be sustainable, you want it to have a long future ahead of it when you've finished with it. And that's really what we're trying to do. So we're financial investors. Our job is to make as big of a financial gain for our investors, the pension funds and sovereign wealth funds that are investing in our funds. Clearly, our job is to maximize our financial gain. However, I really believe, especially in brand investing, that the way to do that is to have an eye on long past our ownership period. And that's why I like this, run it as if you're going to hand it on to your kids. Because I think brands, especially that are run for the short term, and short term can be 1 to 5 years. If you just have your eye on 1 year or 5 years, let alone quarters, I think you will make mistakes. You might maximize your sales this year. You might sell a lot more boots in this country or that country. But if all you're looking at is maximizing 1 or 5 year sales, you're probably going to not invest enough in the qualitative, emotional, magical side of a brand. You're probably going to overextend your distribution. You might raise your prices too much to get sales this year, but in 5 years' time, you're going to have a problem when people think your product's too expensive. So there's a lot of examples where there's a conflict between short-term and long-term in brand investing. And that sentence about run it like you're going to pass it to your kids, for me, captures how we try to tread that balance of creating the absolutely best short-term and medium-term for our investors, whilst making sure we leave a business better than we found it, with decades of healthy performance ahead of it. And in brand investing, I'm just absolutely convinced that you've got to have more of an eye on the long term than you do on the short term. And that's what we try to do.
Pamira had the positive experiences with Valentino and Hugo Boss. And I wonder what you were able to take from those two, or the team took from those two, yes, and apply them to Doc Martens.
A lot. Valentino and Hugo Boss were invested around 2007. So quite a long time ago. We did the Dr. Martens deal in 2013, 6 years apart, but a huge amount of learnings, parallels from Boss and Valentino. I always say that I think Boss and Valentino were really the beginnings of what we now call our brand strategy. We learned different things from them. I mean, if I simplify, Hugo Boss, remember, we're talking about 2007, 8, 9, 10, long time ago. Hugo Boss was a very large wholesale business. So most of the product was sold through department stores or other third parties. And probably the single biggest, or one of the single biggest elements of transformation back when we owned it, was to shift it from being a wholesale-led business to being a retail and direct-to-consumer-led business. So it shifted from selling almost everything through wholesalers to selling the majority of its sales, either through its own stores, which of course means taking on rents and fixed costs and a big shift in business, or through its website. So becoming a direct business rather than a third-party business. That shift is a very, very powerful one because it does two things. It gives you direct access to your consumer. So instead of selling through a department store, you're selling directly to them. You get their email address, you talk to them, you get their feedback, you can develop VIP relationships. So you're literally talking to your consumer. So strategically, it brings the company closer to the consumer, which is valuable for obvious reasons. And then financially, it does something very interesting as well, because if I sell you a shoe through a department store, let's say a Dr. Martens boot costs £110 or £120. If we sell it through the department store, obviously the department store is getting a cut. So the company's probably making, let's say, £60 or £70 of revenue. If we sell it through our own store, we're getting £120 of revenue. So what you can invest back into the business or invest back into the brand is so much more if you sell it through your direct channels than through your indirect channels. So what we call channel shift, going from wholesale to direct, which was the Hugo Boss theme, strategically brings you closer to your customer, but also just really helps your P&L. So you can invest more in the brand for the long term. So Hugo Boss channel shift was a huge theme, and we've applied that to Dr. Martens. It's going on with Golden Goose at the moment as well. And it was a theme at Valentino as well. And then Valentino, that's where magic comes in. I mean, that was a brand with unbelievable heritage, Hollywood glamour and catwalk shows and high fashion and all the glamour and associated history that came with that. But back then, again, forget about the Valentino of today. This was 2007-08. It was really a brand that was more likely to be worn by more mature ladies. And it had lost its connection with younger customers, and it had lost its connection with culture, I would say. And its shops were very tired, hadn't really been invested in, looked a bit shabby. And it had a very tough time in the financial crisis. So there was one great anecdote. There was one day where the revenues of some of the stores after Lehman went bust, revenues didn't go down. The revenues were negative. So people were returning more product than they were buying on a given day after Lehman went bust. Had a very tough time through the financial crisis, but then emerged, thanks to the management team's excellent execution and strategy, in great shape and is now more than £1 billion of revenues. What I want to say about that is the magic of when you have a brand, it's really hard to kill a great brand. What you have from a resilience point of view when you are speaking to customers emotionally and when you have that much heritage and that much history, that much culture, doesn't go away easily. So the resilience of Valentino, even though it had a terrible few years or very challenging few years, the ability to reignite it and bring it back to life and for it to thrive and flourish afterwards is a lesson that was maybe painful at times to learn, but has really stayed with us. The fact that the best brands are actually really resilient. They're not these fickle things that people might think they are. The best brands are really, really resilient. And that's quite core to why we invest in brands today.
So just two final questions before we leave Doc Martens. Is it true that the Pope ordered some enormous quantity for his staff and for himself?
Possibly. I don't know. I genuinely don't know, but I love that fact. And it's very possibly true.
Well, I read that he'd ordered 100 pairs for his staff and a pair of white brogues for himself.
No, it's quite possibly true. There are so many stories like that I don't know them, but it's very possibly true.
Let's also just pause on exits, because when you have taken these stakes and things have worked out, and even when they haven't worked out, but let's stay with the examples such as you've described, when things have worked out, you go for the exit, which can come in various forms. In the case of Doc Martens, you go for a listing, UK stock market, and then I think in January this year, Permira sold 65 million shares at 395. Stocks come down a long way from there, temporarily perhaps. So what I'm intrigued about is less the movement, but how you weigh up the consideration of stay, hold, buy, in your cases, when you are looking long-term, but you're equally trying to realize returns.
We are constantly evaluating in any given company, should we stay, should we go? What's the best path forward? We're not very mechanical about it. We don't say, oh, 5 years have passed, it's time to sell. We also don't say, oh, we've made 2x our money, let's sell. So we're very dynamic and situation specific as a firm about the decision. You will find if you went and analyzed it, we've got companies that we've owned for 2 years and then the right thing came along and we've sold. We've got companies that we've owned for 10 years. Dr. Martens, as I said, we've been in for 8 years and we still own somewhere between 35 and 40% of the company. So a really long-term hold for us, because we see so much value still to come and we are such backers of the management team and feel so good about the strategy that we're very happy to hold that much. I mean, it's not widely known, but we passed on the opportunity to sell 100% of the company several times before we decided to do the IPO. One of the reasons as an investor we liked the public route was it actually allowed us to stay in the shareholding for longer. So the vagaries of the share price are probably not for now and have all kinds of potential explanations, probably not for this podcast, but bigger picture, the way we think about it is, are we backing the management team? Are we still aligned with the strategy? Do we think there's lots more value to go for? Do we think we're still a good owner of this business or good investor? And if the answer to all those questions is yes, we're very happy to stay in for many years past the average.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come. But a quick word on our new sponsor. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, CEO of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine. And as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by Livetrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. Livetrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, bordeauxindex.com/Livetrade. The Money Maze podcast is also brought to you by our final sponsor, Mintus. The world of art investing has been typically out of reach for most investors, and yet returns have been very impressive. Mintus is a new concept in art investing, giving investors the chance to own the unownable through an FCA-authorized and regulated fractionalization platform, which offers access to iconic and rare paintings from contemporary art masters like Warhol, Kondo, Francis Bacon and Basquiat, actual paintings, not digital assets. For investors seeking to diversify their portfolios through an asset class historically uncorrelated with stock market investing and with strong returns, we've been impressed with Mintus and think it merits a closer look. Let's talk about Golden Goose. Permira snaps them up for, I think, 1.3 billion euros. Tell me, what's the investment case? What really got you excited?
So Golden Goose, for those who don't know, it's a luxury sneaker brand. Hopefully everybody knows. And we're 2 years into that investment now. Just before COVID, that investment was made, which was interesting timing, February 2020. What got us excited there, that was a company, truth be told, we had tried to invest in 3 years earlier, so 5 years ago, and failed to buy. It would be pipped to the post by someone else. So we'd been tracking the company for a very long time, knew the management team, CEO Silvio, for many, many years, and had fallen for the business, really, long time ago, as I say, 5 years ago. So we're thrilled that the opportunity came up again in 2020 to invest and get the opportunity to partner with them. What's gotten us excited there? Number one, casualization of luxury. 10 years ago, would you wear a pair of sneakers to the theatre or a Michelin-starred restaurant? No, you probably wouldn't. Today, would you wear a pair of Golden Goose to a Michelin-starred restaurant or the theatre? Absolutely, you would. And Moncler and other brands have paved a path as well and contributed massively in streetwear phenomenon and popular culture and all kinds of explanations. But this theme of casualization of luxury, people wanting to look good, being willing to spend quite a lot of money, but wanting to be comfortable. That's a theme that I just don't think is going away. Like once you figure out that you can look good and be more comfortable than what you used to wear, look at business attire and how that's evolving, you just don't go back. There's lots of things in fashion that are trends that come and go. One of the things we think is that when a new product comes along that helps you look good, feel good, and just be comfy, it just doesn't go away. Jeans, the denim phenomenon is an example of that. So sneakers, casualization, sneakerization, a word people use. I don't really like it because I don't think it's a word, but the sneakerization of footwear we felt was a mega trend that was here to stay. So that's sort of number one. Golden Goose was basically one of the first companies to make luxury sneakers. I mean, today, Gucci, Alexander McQueen, every luxury brand, believe it or not, is selling very expensive sneakers. But Golden Goose was one of the first, or if not the first company to be doing that 20 years ago. It's just celebrated its 20th year anniversary. We think of it as a category creator. It was the first to really create this thing that all the other luxury brands are now building big, big businesses around. So it was a category creator. And then the company and the management team, the amount of dynamism, innovation, creativity in that company is difficult to explain in a podcast. It is a young, vibrant, really innovative and creative group of people who move at lightning speed and come up with fabulous new business model ideas and innovations all the time. And we're very excited to back them So simply speaking, we saw it as a business that just had a huge amount of growth runway to go for. And it really met those things I said at the beginning. What do consumers emotionally feel? How do they behave? What does your P&L look like? Like Dr. Martin's, it really ticked all the boxes for us.
So the other tension and question that always is asked around private equity is the debt equity mix. And I wonder how you think about debt in these consumer brands versus equity.
We tend not to put a huge amount of debt into most of these consumer brands. We tend to be investing in growth businesses as a start. Rather than cash cow stable businesses, we tend to be investing in growth businesses that want to invest a lot of their profits back into growth. So as a general matter, we tend to be very focused on making sure we're not putting a lot of debt on these companies. I think fair to say that we learned some tough lessons about being overlevered in the financial crisis. We did have a number of companies, I'm talking 2008, 2009, long time ago. We had companies back then that were frankly overlevered, and we learned a lot from that. So we worked very hard to make sure we don't overlever companies, and we're not really making our returns. The bulk of our returns are not coming from the fact that we've levered companies. Most of our investment cases aren't centered on how much leverage you can put on a company. I think when we bought Dr. Martin's, we put 3 turns of leverage on it, for example, which quickly became 2 turns as the EBITDA grew and then went to 0. And then we left it with 0, close to 0 net debt for years. And we had bankers coming and saying, oh, why don't you relever it? And you could take a dividend and take a return by relevering it. And we never did that because for various reasons at the time, we didn't think that was the best thing to do for our investors or the company. So I say that to say that, of course, leverage is important part of the private equity business model, but it's not the central way we seek to make our returns. And we've got many companies that you could argue are underlevered in our portfolio. And some of that is lessons learned the hard way in the past. So that's how we think about it.
Do you, when you sit down and review your portfolio and potential investments, bring into the equation the macro environment? We've had a very favorable set of tailwinds, which may or may not be reversing. As many will have listened to the conversations we've had on this podcast, I think they are. Inflation proving more sticky, rates, you know, rising, recession on the horizon. Luxury goods have marched to a slightly different beat. But how do you, or do you, bring that into your thinking when you're planning?
We absolutely do, with the caveat that we are not economists or macro investors. We are very unlikely to make an investment that is predicated on the macro being this way or that way. We're not calling the macro. That's not what we're best at, and that's not what we're seeking to do. But absolutely, the direction of travel, tailwinds or headwinds of macro play a huge part in our thinking. The situation is changing rapidly. So we're spending a lot of time at the moment talking about inflation and interest rates and commodity prices, and bringing it to my world of brand investing. What's that going to mean for consumers and their disposable incomes and their ability to buy discretionary things versus non-discretionary things on the consumer demand side? And then on the P&L side of companies, what's it going to mean for their cost bases and inflation levels? And we're seeing inflation in virtually every company that we own, and what kind of pricing power do they have? So we're very, very alert to changing macro winds and reflect that in types of businesses we look at. Valuations will pay. So valuations are when the public markets valuations have come down quite a lot recently. There's a bit of a lag between private and public market valuations reacting to the macro, but absolutely really live topic for us right now.
And you've been very successful in this brand space. Others will have observed that and practiced it at the same time. How about the competitive challenges when iconic brands or once iconic brands come around?
The fun thing of brand investing is everybody knows what all these brands are, and you can talk to your parents or your friends about what you do, or your children, and they know what you do. The annoying thing about brand investing is that everybody sees these brands and runs around having good ideas, and they're very visible. So absolutely, whenever you're buying a brand, almost always, there's fierce competition, especially if you're buying a good one. But interestingly, it's not a space where there's a huge amount of corporate M&A activity, unlike tech or healthcare. You don't have gigantic corporates hoovering up all the best brands in the world. So of course you have LVMH and Kering at the luxury end and a few others. You have a few Capri Holdings or Tapestry that buy more premium brands. You have VF Corporation and quite outdoorsy and streetwear brands. So you do have these strategic buyers, but it's not a hugely acquisitive space from a corporate M&A activity point of view, which means it's a space that we can play in. So we don't see the same buyers showing up all the time. in terms of private equity competition, there aren't that many private equity firms that have dedicated teams and time and resource to this space. It's competitive, of course it is, but it's not quite the same as technology where everybody wants to be a technology investor. And then you've got the wild card with brands. You've got high net worth individuals who want to buy a brand, or sovereign wealth funds, trophy hunters. So you get these wild card buyers that will sometimes just pay up to buy a brand. That happens from time to time.
Now, you mentioned technology. I know it's not your silo, but Permira has been very successful. I think Philip Bassett said it's been the most successful vertical for Permira, not to take anything away from the consumer franchise. But the success that Permira has had, it does appear that they've been quite early in a number of the big evolutions. To what do you attribute that?
It's true. Our technology team and franchise has been hugely successful, which is great for all the other teams as well, because technology touches every sector now. So one thing some of the technology partners often say is, do we need a technology team? One day technology will just be integrated into every other sector team. So to what do we attribute that? Like all things, I think it comes down to people and the firm's culture, ability to move fast, and the firm's ability to evolve and be agile and adapt its investment strategy. So I think we opened a Menlo Park office on the west coast of the United States about 15 years ago. I forget the exact year, but Richard Sanders went out and opened that office and hired Brian Ruder, and they built out a team, and the firm adapted and followed, and they got the backing of the investment committee and the firm to deploy increasingly over time. So I think the firm's culture of evolution, change, agility, and entrepreneurialism, and the key individuals around the table is what I would put that down to.
So let me move to some closing and final questions. What's your perfect day when you're not at work?
I have two young boys. So my perfect day when I'm not at work probably involves being outdoors in good weather, somewhere warm with them and my husband, with some friends for one meal and a good book.
What would the book be? Or what is the book that you're currently reading, or the book that you would give to a friend above all else?
So I'll do a fiction and a non-fiction then, if I may. Fiction, I've just finished Kazuo Ishiguro, who remains of the day, who wrote that. He's written a new book called Clara and the Sun, which is phenomenal. I don't read a lot of fiction, and I just couldn't put it down. Beautiful, thought-provoking book that I would recommend to anyone. And non-fiction, there is one book I also always like to recommend to everyone, whoever they are, whatever walk of life. It's quite well known, so it's not very original, but it's called Mindset by Carol Dweck. Do you know it?
I know of it. I have not read it.
You must read it. It is about growth mindsets and fixed mindsets. And I think whoever you are, whether you work, don't work, or you're a parent, you're career oriented or whatever, I think it's got so much in it that I find really thought provoking and I kind of turn to a lot. So those are my two book recommendations.
And which company anywhere in the world not owned by Permira do you think you admire most?
Patagonia. It's a brand, so it's in my world. And it's privately owned by the founder. And it treads that balance between being an excellent business whilst being a truly special and authentic brand that I really think does care about the planet and make its decisions differently because it has a real sense of being mission and purpose driven. And trying to make the world a better place whilst also being an excellent business. So this concept of a double bottom line, and I think they achieve that beautifully and very inspirationally.
Thank you. Now, we've had a lot of very successful women on the Money Makes podcast in finance and business, and I understand, well, you just said you have two young sons. What advice would you give to women in finance? Number one, about career paths, and number two, about juggling dual immense responsibilities.
If only I had the answer to the second one. I would say find something where you can be your true self. That means a company, who the people are, but also the nature of the job. Go and work with or for people that allow you to be yourself, because you will only do your best work when you can be yourself. And in terms of choosing the nature of the job, if it's a bank or a corporation or an investment firm or a consultancy firm or anything else, make sure you're truly motivated by the substance of it and it feels relevant to you. The thought behind all of that is, I think you will achieve the most you can in your career when you can bring your best self out. And I spend a lot of time on this topic. Sadly, the research shows that there's a lot of insider-outsider dynamics in male-dominated environments. Women as outsiders, even if they don't realize it or the men don't realize it, are subconsciously having to change how they behave, think, act, talk, dress, everything. Half your brain is spent not being yourself, then half your brain is lost that could be spent on much more productive activities. So find somewhere and some people that you can be yourself with.
Terrific. And finally, after that great book, if you could tell us just one thing.
If I could tell you just one thing, it would be about growth mindset. That is the book, Carol Dweck's Mindset, that has probably had the biggest impact on me. And it doesn't matter if you're a growth mindset person or a fixed mindset person. I think there is so much in your personal life or in your career. There is so much to take from that book. So that one thing would be develop a growth mindset, read the book, and think about how you can develop your growth mindset.
So much good stuff there. I've written down lots of things. I like this term. I'm not sure if I like it. I recognize this casualization of luxury. Mm. I'm not sure, you know, again, somebody who wore Dr. Martens actually in a brief punk period a long time ago, I must admit that I haven't been maybe casualizing my wardrobe. I'm going to take that last comment you make, which is for young people, it doesn't matter whether it's men or women, but work with people who allow you to be yourself. That's really important advice. And what an exciting job you have and what a good job you appear to be doing. So congratulations on these exciting stories that you're involved with. And thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.